Welcome to today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Thursday, March 14th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled, Snow Problem. Sioux City Snow Removal Budget on Target for the Year. It's written by Jared McNett. Even with record-breaking winter storms heralding the start of 2024, Sioux City officials say the municipal snow removal budget is on target for the year. We definitely still have enough that if we continue to have snow events, we will be plenty covered, Sioux City Field Services Supervisor Patrick Simons said Tuesday. There's no worry that if we try and have a surplus on hand at all times. That also kind of helps combat some issues in preparing for fall for next year. We'll carry it over until the next year. From January 8th through 13th, when 20 inches of powder fell on the Sioux City area, Simons said his department had split snow removal shifts comprised of about 70 total workers, around 20 at night and around 50 in the daytime. All of those individuals are ready for any kind of snow event, he said. Despite some days and nights for those folks, Simmons said overtime didn't exhaust the overall budget. While overtime pay is a key component of the snow removal budget, it's not the only slice of the pie. Simons said operating supplies such as chains, cutting edges for the snow plows, which help avoid damage to pavement, diesel fuel, salt, and de-icing sand to give traction on road surfaces and stretch the salt supply, all factor into the budget. With the salt, Simons said the department makes purchases in the off-season by putting out a contract for bid and going with whomever can promise the best price and reliability. Sioux City Finance Director Teresa Fitch said the most recent snow removal budget was about $1.6 million, which is roughly 15% of the total budget for the street maintenance operating budget, not including money spent on major reconstruction projects. She said the budget funding comes from road use taxes, and through this week, approximately 87% of the snow removal budget has been expended for the year. While coming under budget or on target isn't necessarily a boon for the present moment, Fitch said it can be beneficial down the line. It does help the street department from year to year. It helps to fill some gaps in future years if there are issues, she said. Because bad winter weather in a single calendar year isn't easy to budget for, Fitch said the city calculates a three-year average and inflates whatever the result is because the number will move up every year. Excepting January, winter in Sioux City, which ends March 19th, was somewhat normal. From December 21st, when winter began, to December 31st, Sioux City was hit with 6.5 inches of snow, which was nearly 2 inches less than what's considered typical for the month. February saw 3.7 inches, 5 inches off of the normal mark. It's been dry. We didn't get as much snow as normal, and we didn't get as much liquid out of the snow, said Kent Masters, a technician for the National Weather Service, Sioux Falls office. There really wasn't a whole wet snow for this winter. Masters said there's always a chance of flakes in April, and if some do come, a heavy wet snow is possible. In the meantime, Simon said that the people tasked with doing snow removal will be busy with other responsibilities. The same staff that run our plow trucks are the same staff that take care of our gravel roads and take care of our concrete streets and does our pothole patching, he said. We continue to move forward with business as usual, and then we just kind of take a pause on our daily activities for snow events and then revert back to whatever tasks we were working on prior to that. Next is an article entitled, District Offers Its Proposal to Unions. Offers less than Sioux City Teachers Unions sought. It's written by Caitlin Yamada. The Sioux City School District presented its opening proposals Wednesday in contract negotiation with the unions representing their classroom teachers. The district made their pitch to the Sioux City Education Association and the Sioux City Education Support Personnel Association for the 2024-2025 school year. The two unions offered their proposals last week. For the SCEA, the school district proposes a $45 increase to the base salary from $38,711 to $38,756 and a $45 increase to longevity pay. The SCEA proposed a 4.5% base salary increase and a $1,500 increase in longevity pay. The percentage increase would result in a $1,742 base pay increase from $38,711 to $40,453. For SCESPA, The school district proposes a 42 cent an hour increase and no changes to longevity. Hourly minimum in both schedules will increase 80% of the wage increase, and hourly maximum in both schedules will increase 100% of the wage increase, according to the proposal. The SCESPA proposed a $2.10 an hour increase in the and the addition of two new longevity pay categories. 5 years would give a $50 monthly increase, and 10 years would give a $100 increase. The SCESPA also proposed increasing current longevity pay for 15 years from $75 to $150, for 20 years from $100 to $200, and for 25 years from $125 to $250. Under state law, the opening proposal from employee unions and the response from the district are open to the public. Subsequent bargaining sessions are held behind closed doors. The SCEA has steep step increases in its contract that give a base salary increase for every additional year of service, including that base increase the longevity pay asks and TSS increase. Documents provided by the district show a 6.55% increase from the SCEA proposal. The district's proposal would be a 2.51% increase. For the SCESPA, the $2.10 increase is a 12.7% hourly increase, according to district administration. The district's proposal would be a 2.54% increase. The final story from the front page of the journal today is entitled "Lawmaker Pulls Bill Critics Say Imperils IVF." It's written by Aaron Murphy of the Journal Des Moines Bureau. In vitro fertilization's future in Iowa will not face legal uncertainty after all, at least for the moment. A legislative proposal from State House Republicans to increase criminal penalties when an individual causes the termination of a pregnancy without the mother's consent, a proposal that also amended state law in a way that critics warned would endanger fertility treatments like in vitro fertilization, will no longer be considered by state lawmakers this year, a key legislator said Wednesday. Senator Brad Zahn, a Republican from Urbandale and chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, said he did not advance the legislation specifically because of questions about its potential impact on in vitro fertilization. "I would say this. There was some definite concerns about in vitro fertilization and the negative effects and unintended consequences with that bill, and that was very problematic for myself," Zahn told reporters after Wednesday's committee meeting, "and so that's why I pulled the bill. With that action, the bill essentially is ineligible for consideration for the remainder of the 2024 legislative session. However, legislative leaders in the majority party, which in both chambers of the Iowa legislature is Republicans, have tools and tricks at their disposal to resurrect any dead bills if they choose. In vitro fertilization is a fertility treatment by which a woman's egg is combined with a man's sperm in a medical lab and then planting those embryos in the woman's uterus. Critics have warned the proposed legislation could have made IVF illegal because as part of the process, extra embryos are sometimes frozen, stored, or discarded. They argued the bill does not sufficiently exempt fertility treatments. During debate in the Iowa House, Republicans insisted the bill, House File 2575, would not impact fertility treatments and that its focus specifically was on the crime of non-consensual termination of a pregnancy. The bill passed out of the House on a 58-36 vote with only Republicans supporting it. On Wednesday, Representative Steve Holt, a Republican from Denison who chairs the House Judiciary Committee, told reporters that House Republicans believed the bill would not have impacted fertility treatments and that comparisons to issues that have arisen after an Alabama Supreme Court ruling in that state are not applicable to Iowa because of differences in the state's constitutions. The Alabama Supreme Court ruled last month that frozen embryos can be considered children under state law. Alabama legislators facing pushback after treatments were stopped at some of that state's largest fertility clinics rushed past a bill this month shielding doctors from legal liability because of the court opinion. Holt said that he understood the concern raised about the Iowa bill's proposed potential impact. "I understand the concerns about IVF," Holt said. "We did not necessarily believe that there was an issue related to IVF, but I understand the concerns there. I believe life begins at conception. I also think we have to come to terms with how we're going to deal with the IVF issue, so I understand the concerns there. Next up, North Sioux City robbery suspect agrees to extradition. A Sioux City man suspected of robbing a North Sioux City bank has agreed to be returned to South Dakota to face charges. Dennis Manchester, age 44, waived extradition Wednesday morning in Woodbury County District Court in Sioux City and will be transported to the Union County Jail in Elk Point, South Dakota. No court hearings have yet been scheduled in Union County Circuit Court. He is being held in the Woodbury County Jail in the meantime. Manchester was arrested on Tuesday on charges of first-degree robbery, aggravated assault, grand theft, and driving under suspension. North Sioux City Police Chief Richard Headed said Tuesday that Manchester walked into Liberty National Bank at 113 Military Road at 2:43 p.m. and handed a teller a note demanding money or someone would be hurt and displayed a knife. According to court documents, Manchester left the bank with $3,508 in cash and fled in a car that had been parked in a nearby parking lot. Manchester was stopped shortly after the robbery near West 19th and John Streets in Sioux City and taken into custody without incident. The money taken from the bank and a knife were recovered from the car. During an interview with police after his arrest, Manchester admitted robbing the bank, court documents said. No bank employees were injured in the robbery. A couple brief articles. First, woman to enter plea in Vermilion murder case, Dateline Vermilion, South Dakota. An Omaha woman charged with a fatal stabbing in Vermilion is scheduled to change her plea. A change of plea hearing has been scheduled for March the 28th for Shazaya Liggins, age 20, who pleaded not guilty in August in Clay County Circuit Court to one count of second-degree murder and two counts of first-degree manslaughter. No plea agreement or other documents pertaining to the plea change have yet been filed. Liggins is charged with stabbing Christopher Battling, age 47 of Vermilion, on July the 30th at an apartment at 205 Spruce Street. According to court documents, Liggins admitted to police officers she stabbed the man in the back twice with a knife. Liggins was arrested on a charge of first-degree murder, alleging she stabbed Battling with premeditation. A grand jury later indicted her on the second-degree murder charge, which alleges she acted without premeditation. And Bancroft Rosalie voters pass $18 million school bond issue. This comes from Bancroft, Nebraska. Voters in the Bancroft Rosalie Public School District on Tuesday passed a nearly $18 million bond issue to fund construction of a new school gymnasium and other building improvements. Needing 50% approval, the issue passed 253-209. In addition to the new gym, stage, and locker rooms, the $17.95 million in bonds will pay for construction of additional classrooms, a community fitness area, and a new music room. Plans also call for renovations to the 1968 elementary school, 1939 gym, and the existing weight room for wrestling. Other projects included in the bond issue are modernizing learning spaces, security upgrades, added life skills space, shop classroom renovations / expansion, upgraded ag education facilities, and updates to the Rosalie Gym and an enclosed bus stop. Now we come to an article entitled South O'Brien District Reaches $625,000 Settlement. The dateline is Paulina, Iowa. The South O'Brien Community School District has reached a $625,000 settlement of a negligence lawsuit involving the sexual abuse of a high school special education student by another student. Filed in September of 2021 in O'Brien County District Court, the lawsuit alleged the then 16-year-old student was sexually assaulted by another special education student numerous times from December of 2018 to March 15, 2019, in a school restroom after their teacher gave the two, who were often the only students in the special education classroom, permission to leave the room to use the restroom. Lindsay and David Thompson sued the district, special education teacher John Miller, principal Stephen Bruder, and superintendent Dan Moore, all of whom are no longer with the district, saying the school failed to adequately supervise the students and have adequate policies and procedures to prevent sexual assault and harassment. The Thompsons are grateful that the school district has been held accountable for such a preventable tragedy, their attorney, Robert Reichenberg of West Des Moines, said in a statement. It was a long road to travel, but one that we sincerely pray will have a lasting positive impact on the education of disabled students in this state. No family should have to experience what took place in South O'Brien High School. Students must be safe at school. We are grateful to see the positive changes that were undertaken by the new administration before the lawsuit was even filed. The school district's attorney, Doug Phillips of Sioux City, declined comment on the settlement. The lawsuit was dismissed Tuesday, after a judge approved the settlement. There's three more brief articles. Two jailed after Sioux County courtroom disturbance. Dateline is Orange City, Iowa. Two people were jailed for contempt after a disturbance Monday in a Sioux County courtroom. Sioux County Sheriff's deputies were summoned to a courtroom in the Sioux County Courthouse at approximately 4 p.m. for a report of a disorderly person inside the courtroom. According to a news release from the Sheriff's Office, deputies found Jeremy Davies, who was agitated and using profane language while demanding to speak with a judge. After the judge told him to stop his actions, Davies continued his abusive language and the judge ordered him to be held in contempt of court. The judge also ordered Ashley Shopman, who was with Davies at the hearing, to stop taking video of the incident. After she refused to do so, the judge ordered her to be held in contempt also. The judge ordered both Davies, age 45, and Shopman, age 38, both of Howardin, Iowa, to be transported to the Sioux County Jail and be held for 24 hours. Davies also was charged with disorderly conduct. Man charged with interfering with firefighters. This is Dateline Spirit Lake, Iowa. A Spirit Lake man was arrested Monday after authorities say he interfered with firefighters at the scene of a fire. Dickinson County Sheriff's deputies were called to the 1400 block of 193rd Avenue in rural Dickinson County at about 9:30 p.m. According to court documents, Caleb Crosby had showed up at the scene and interfered with firefighters who were putting out hot spots and investigating the cause of the fire. Crosby refused to leave and resisted arrest when deputies were taking him into custody. He was found in possession of brass knuckles, a small plastic baggie containing methamphetamine, and a glass meth pipe. Crosby, age 19, was arrested on charges of possession of drug paraphernalia, possession of a controlled substance, person ineligible to carry a dangerous weapon, and two counts of interference with official acts. And motorcyclist killed in Yankton County crash. This is Dateline Volin, South Dakota. A motorist was killed Tuesday after colliding with a truck near Volin, South Dakota. The crash occurred at 5 p.m. northwest of Volin at 301st Street and 446th Avenue, where the eastbound motorcycle struck a septic tanker truck that was turning into a field. According to the South Dakota Department of Public Safety, the motorcycle driver was traveling on 301st Street behind a semi-trailer. The septic tanker truck was also eastbound in front of the semi-trailer. As the tanker truck slowed down to turn north, the motorcycle driver passed the semi-trailer and struck the side of the tanker truck as it was turning. The rider, a 65-year-old male who was not wearing a helmet, was thrown from the motorcycle and died at the scene. The 54-year-old truck driver was not injured. The names of the persons involved have not been released pending notification of family members. The South Dakota Highway Patrol continues to investigate the crash. Now we've come to an article entitled, VT Industries Breaks Ground on $16 Million Expansion. Will add 175,000 square feet to Holstein plant. It's written by Mason Doctor, and the dateline is Holstein, Iowa. Door and countertop manufacturer VT Industries on Wednesday held a ceremonial groundbreaking for a major expansion of their plant in Holstein. The $16 million expansion will add 175,000 square feet to the production footprint at the Holstein campus, the company said in a press release. This is the company's largest expansion to date. The expansion is expected to be finished in the spring of next year. The Holstein plant at present has the capacity to produce 20,000 commercial architectural wood doors per week, according to the company. VT Industries, which employs roughly 2,000 people in the United States and Canada, was founded in Holstein by Roger Clausen in 1956. The company is now helmed by the second and third generation of the Clausen family, Rogers' son, CEO and Chairman Doug Clausen, and his sons, Senior Vice President of the Countertop Division Ryan Clausen and Vice President of Operations of the Door Division Aaron Clausen. This expansion and investment in technology continues to strengthen the valued customer partnerships that have afforded VT its growth throughout the past 68 years, and it will sustain us well into the future, Doug Clausen said in a statement. The company's products can be found in high places, including Yankee Stadium and the University of Iowa Children's Hospitals, among others. Chick-fil-A says second Sioux City locations to bring 80 to 120 jobs. This is written by Jared McNett of the Sioux City Journal and the Dateline in Sioux City. Chick-fil-A Incorporated confirmed it is actively pursuing a new restaurant in Sioux City and said the new store would create as many as 120 jobs. Site plans for the location, which would be the second in town, list an address for 820 Hamilton Boulevard, where a vacant Cricket Wireless store currently sits. An email from Chick-fil-A Incorporated puts the address as 800 Hamilton Boulevard. The other store for the popular chicken purveyor sits at 4428 Sargent Road. The Tuesday afternoon agenda for Sioux City's Planning and Zoning Commission included an item to discuss, requested site plan approval for the property located at the southeast corner of the intersection of Hamilton Boulevard and Wesley Parkway. The documents note the building footprint would be around 5,177 square feet and the number of employees during the largest shift would be around 15. We look forward to working through the approval process with Sioux City and are excited by the prospect of expanding our presence in Sioux City, Chick-fil-A Inc. said in an email. Each locally owned and operated restaurant creates 80 to 120 jobs in the area. We hope to have the opportunity to serve new guests delicious food in an environment of genuine hospitality. In the past several weeks, plans for a number of chains opening in Sioux City have been advanced or confirmed. The Wingstop chain of chicken wing restaurants is planning to open a Sioux City location this spring. On February 26, the Sioux City Council approved a resolution announcing the city's intent to accept a proposal from McDonald's USA Incorporated to purchase land at 3100 Floyd Boulevard in Floyd Valley Crossing. An assistant public relations manager for Freddy's Frozen Custard and Steak Burgers told the Journal in late February that the company is targeting an opening date at 5842 Sunnybrook Drive in July. Quickstar is also planning to open a convenience store in Sioux City later this year. The gas station will be at 2500 Glen Avenue, just off South Lewis Boulevard near the Floyd Monument, said Ben Leibel, a spokesperson for Quick Trip, the parent company of Quickstar. State gives $1.2 million for Siouxland Splash Road. This is written by Dolly Butts of the Sioux City Journal. The Iowa Transportation Commission approved more than $1.2 million in grant funding Tuesday for the construction of a roadway to support a new water park in Sioux City. The city of Sioux City will receive up to $1,250,957 to assist with the construction of approximately 410 feet of new roadway and turn lanes on Highway 75 North. The project is expected to be completed by December. Siouxland Splash, 3820 Highway 75, is slated to be open for business by the summer of 2025 and is under design by a team of water park consultants. Sioux City currently has several public pools and splash pads, but no water parks. Last month, the City Council approved a resolution supporting a grant application to the DOT's Revitalize Iowa's Sound Economy, or RISE, program for the construction of the roadway. An Iowa DOT review determined that turn lanes in both directions will be required to safely allow traffic to decelerate and make the turn from Highway 75, which is under the DOT's jurisdiction, to the water park. Siouxland Splash's site plan also requires a short access road connecting the entrance to the turn lanes to be built on Highway 75. The RISE program offers funding to road projects from a newly created tourism category. A local match is required from the city. The city engineers estimate the for construction of the road is $1,375,925, and the estimate for the turning lanes is $1,125,988. Frontline Development LLC, a group of local investors, intends to invest an estimated $12 to $15 million to build the water park. Joe Ziering, partner and co-owner of Frontline Development LLC, previously told the council that the park will have a lazy river, wave pool, and one of the biggest kids zones in the Midwest. We're going to have a huge slide tower with actually a really iconic slide. It's going to be the first one in the United States, Ziering said. We're going to really try and make a big impact for Sioux City here. We want to make this a really fun staple in the community. Now we turn to the opinion page and we have another view from the London Guardian entitled Russian Opposition Needs Help. Elections this week are a sham, but they must not demoralize those who criticize Putin. Article 13 of the Russian Constitution promises political pluralism. Article 29 guarantees freedom of speech. It is a brave citizen who insists on those rights. Though Russia will hold a presidential election at the end of this week, the result is a foregone conclusion. Vladimir Putin will win comfortably. The spirit of post-Soviet democratization is all but dead. The flame is kept alive by a courageous few. Thousands turned out at the Moscow funeral of Alexei Navalny. The jailed opposition leader generally assumed to have been murdered by order of the Kremlin. Chants called for Russia without Putin. This is high-risk activity. Open dissent against the regime is punishable by fines and prison sentences. OVD Info, a human rights group, has categorized hundreds of detentions in dozens of cities after vigils in honor of Navalny. It has been the largest show of opposition since the invasion of Ukraine, but the numbers are not huge for a country of 144 million. What the majority of Russians think about their president and his war is opaque. Independent analysts say the picture is nuanced, a spectrum of sentiment with ideological pro-Kremlin conviction shading into looser patriotic sympathy with the army and then degrees of apathy, low-level discontent, grim resignation, despair, and a kernel of committed anti-regime activists. Putin's position is secured by brute force and cultivated disbelief that any alternative is viable. He achieves this by eliminating rivals and propagating a personality cult that depicts Russia as the target of foreign dismemberment plot and himself as the only person to hold the country together. This week's election is not meant to fool anyone into thinking that Russians have a choice. It is a ritual affirmation of incumbent power, but even the pretense of a ballot gives the opposition something to rally around. Yulia Navalnaya, the murdered dissent's widow, has called for anti-Putin voters to converge on polling stations at midday on Sunday, even if they don't intend to vote. The point is to be visible. These are wholly symbolic gestures, but that doesn't mean they are futile. Russians who dare to speak up for democracy and those who silently crave the end of Putin need reminding that they are not alone. There is a role also for those outside Russia who can amplify voices of courage and hope. Jailed opposition figures Ilya Yashin and Vladimir Kara-Murza risk suffering the same fate as Navalny. The more conspicuous their plight, the harder it is for Putin to pretend his is the only vision of Russian politics. The freedoms that are promised in Russia's constitution feel remote today, as this week's election will sadly demonstrate, but it will show also that the spirit of opposition cannot be extinguished. A second opinion piece written by Eugene Robinson, who writes for the Washington Post, is entitled After Oscars, Don't Be a Ken About Country's Dark History. The Academy Awards ceremony this year was about history, consequences, and choices. We can grapple with what we have wrought if we choose to do so, or we can spend our lives singing and dancing because it's a whole lot more fun just being Ken. Oppenheimer was the night's big winner, taking home Oscars for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Actor, Best Supporting Actor, Best Cinematography, Best Film Editing, and Best Original Score. That haul was richly deserved. Nolan pulled off an improbable coup, making a three-hour blockbuster about a physicist who supervised other physicists in the writing of equations. Oppenheimer has earned nearly $1 billion at the box office so far, and rightly been acclaimed as a great work of cinematic art. But the movie's biggest impact is to make us look at the history we'd rather pretend never happened. Its subject, J. Robert Oppenheimer, led the Manhattan Project that created and tested the world's first nuclear weapons. As Murphy's portrayal vividly shows, Oppenheimer was haunted by his world-changing accomplishment. He had ensured that the United States and the Allies would win World War II, but at the cost of giving humanity the means to destroy itself. Oppenheimer was conflicted about arming one nation with just two such weapons. Today, nine countries, the United States, Russia, China, France, Britain, India, Pakistan, Israel, and North Korea, combined have thousands of nuclear warheads, many of which are hundreds of times more powerful than the U.S. bombs that claimed over 100,000 lives in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Some argue that nuclear weapons, because of the unthinkable horror of using them, have paradoxically helped keep the peace. But we are at one of those moments when the world is dancing dangerously close to the edge. Russian troops are being held at bay by NATO-supplied arms in Ukraine. China is threatening a takeover of Taiwan. Israel is conducting an invasion of Gaza that is partly a proxy war against Iran. Oppenheimer reminds us how costly one false move could be. The Zone of Interest, which won the Oscar for Best International Feature, also offered a history lesson with implications for today. It depicts the life of the family of the German officer who ran the Auschwitz death camp during the Holocaust. One especially chilling scene shows the commandant's wife deciding where to plant azaleas in her garden, while on the other side of a thin wall, Jews were being systematically slaughtered on an industrial scale. It was hard not to see a direct line between the Zone of Interest and the recent resurgence of hateful, unapologetic anti-Semitism. The film's writer and director, Jonathan Glazer, connected those dots in his acceptance speech. But Glazer went further, linking his film's lessons of the past to the ongoing brutality of Israel's war in Gaza. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people, he said. Whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all the victims of this dehumanization, how do we resist? The historical epic that received no love Sunday night was director Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, which was nominated in 10 categories but came away empty-handed. Perhaps the film was hurt by its daunting length, 3 hours and 26 minutes, or maybe its subject, the murders of Native Americans in Oklahoma by white men who stole the Osage Nation's oil-rich land, hit too close to home. But there was nothing but love for Ken, the doll as portrayed by Ryan Gosling. The year's biggest box office success, Barbie, lost to Oppenheimer as Best Picture, but Gosling's performance of I'm Just Ken, one of the movie's songs, was the show-stopping highlight of the evening. It was a kaleidoscope production number that paid homage to Marilyn Monroe's performance of Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend in Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, but with the guy instead of the gal. Being Ken looked like a lot more fun than wrestling with our country's dark history. Somehow, though, we need to find time and focus for both. You are listening to the Sioux City Journal on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments or concerns about this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we turn to today's obituaries, and we start by remembering Mary Ann Voss Lone, age 86, of Laurel, formerly of Newcastle and Wynot, passed away on Sunday, March the 10th, at the Hillcrest Care Center. Funeral services will be at 11 a.m. Friday, March 15th, at the Congregational United Church of Christ, with Pastor Joyce Cook officiating. Visitation with the family present will be 1 hour prior to services at the church. Interment will follow at the Newcastle City Cemetery. Moore Funeral Home of Ponca is assisting the family. Online condolences may be offered at www.meyerbroschapel.com meyerbrochs.com. And that's meyerbrochaples.com. Next, we remember Ernest Rick Baugh of Battle Creek, Iowa, 82 years old, who passed away March 9th, 2024. Memorial service at 10 a.m. March 16th, First Presbyterian Church in Battle Creek. Inurnment at Mount Hope Cemetery in Battle Creek. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. March 15th at Christensen Van Houten Funeral Home in Ida Grove, Iowa. Now we remember Lula L. Watkins, age 90, formerly of Sioux City, who passed away March 10th. A graveside service will be 10 a.m. Friday, March 15th at Memorial Park Cemetery. And we remember Dr. Robert Vernon Powell, age 91, of Kingsley, who passed away the afternoon of Tuesday, March the 5th, at his home, surrounded by family after a three-plus-year battle with cancer. Services will be held at the Road Funeral Home in Kingsley on Saturday, March 16th, with visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. A celebration of life will follow the visitation. The service will be live-streamed. In lieu of flowers, please direct memorials to the KP Scholarship Fund for students entering into the medical or veterinary sciences at 322 Quest Avenue, Kingsley, Iowa, 51028. Condolences to the family may be directed to Mark and Tammy at roadfh.com. And that's Mark, MarkAndTami, at road, roadfh.com. And we remember Frank L. Nelson, who died at Meadow Peak Memory Care Facility in Salt Lake City on February 13th. Frank was truly one of a kind. He was brilliant, caring, generous, and thoughtful, and had an extraordinary sense of humor. He had an insatiable appetite for knowledge and was a voracious reader. He was a truth seeker, saying what he truly thought, sometimes with a filter, sometimes not. Frank was born in Sioux City on August 11, 1948, to Helen and Franklin Nelson. He attended East High School in Sioux City, where he was a gifted basketball player. He later played Division I basketball at the University of Iowa, graduating with a double major in anthropology and history. After graduation, he hitchhiked throughout the United States and ended up in Wenatchee, Washington, where he learned the art of tree pruning. In 1977, he moved to Salt Lake City, where he was a master pruner for over 40 years with loyal clients throughout the Salt Lake Valley. 2 years ago, Frank had a tragic fall from a pruning ladder and suffered traumatic injuries. Even with those challenges, he maintained his sense of humor and his independent spirit. In remembrance of Frank, please consider donating to Tree Utah or Enjoy a Walk in the Wild. As Edward Abbey wrote, wilderness is not a luxury, but a necessity of the human spirit. And we remember Michael E. McMahon, age 73, of Sioux City, who passed away on Sunday, March the 10th, at the Unity Point Health St. Luke's of Sioux City. A funeral service will be held at 1 p.m. Saturday, March 16th, at the Cornerstone World Outreach of Sioux City. Burial will be at the Memorial Park Cemetery of Sioux City. A visitation will be held from 7 to 9 p.m. on Friday, March 15th, at the Cornerstone World Outreach of Sioux City. The Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Mobile is in charge of the arrangements. Now we remember Dr. Carolyn J. Rance, age 87, of Sioux City, who died at her home unexpectedly Friday, March the 8th. A celebration of her life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 16th, at First United Methodist Church, with visitation 1 hour prior. The family is being assisted with arrangements by Christy Smith Funeral Homes, Morningside Chapel. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at www.christysmith.com. And finally, we remember Deborah K. Modlin, age 69, of Winnebago, who passed away on Friday, March the 8th, at Mercy One Medical Center in Sioux City. The visitation and prayer service was held Wednesday, March 13th, at St. Augustine Catholic Church in Winnebago. The Mass of Christian Burial will be 10:30 a.m. on Thursday, March 14th, at St. Augustine Catholic Church, with Father Mark Barron celebrating Mass. Burial will be in Evergreen Cemetery in Walt Hill, Nebraska. Memorials are suggested to the family for future designation. arrangements are under the direction of Munderlow Smith Funeral Home in Pender, Nebraska. Now it's time to turn to sports, and we'll go over what's on television today. I hope you like men's college basketball, because there's plenty of that going on. At 10:30 a.m. on the USA Network, it's the Atlantic 10 Tournament. At 11 a.m. on the Big Ten Network, it's the Big Ten Tournament, Minnesota versus Michigan State in Minneapolis. On ESPN, it's the Atlantic Coast Tournament. And on FS1, it's the Big East Tournament, all at 11 a.m. At 11:30 a.m. on ESPN2, it's the Big 12 Tournament. On ESPNU, the American Athletic Tournament. At 12 p.m. on SEC Network, it's Southeastern Tournament. And at 1 p.m. on USA, it's Atlantic 10 Tournament. 1:30 p.m. on the Big Ten Network, it's the Big Ten Tournament. It's a second-round game with a team to be determined playing Wisconsin. On ESPN2, it's the Atlantic Coast Tournament. ESPNU's got the American Athletic Tournament. FS1 has the Big East Tournament, St. John's versus Seton Hall from New York. 2 p.m. on CBS Sports Network, it's the Mountain West Tournament. ESPN has the Big 12 Tournament. And the Pac-12 Network has the Pac-12 Tournament, of course. 2:30 p.m. on the SEC Network, it's the Southeastern Conference Tournament. 4 p.m. on USA, it's the Atlantic 10 Tournament. 4:30 p.m. on CBS Sports Network, it's another Mountain West Tournament game, San Diego versus UNLV. And Pac-12 has the Pac-12 Tournament. 5:30 p.m., Big Ten Tournament has Ohio State versus Iowa, which is a second-round game. 6 p.m. on ESPN and the Atlantic Coast Tournament. ESPN2's got the Big 12 Tournament, and it's a team to be determined versus Iowa State. On ESPNU, the American Athletic Tournament, Tulane versus North Texas. FS1's got the Big East Tournament, team to be determined versus Creighton. And SEC Network has Southeastern, the tournament, Mississippi versus Texas A&M. 6:30 p.m. on USA is the Atlantic 10 Tournament. 8 p.m. on the Big Ten Network is the Big Ten Tournament, a team to be determined versus Indiana. CBS Sports Network at 8 p.m. has the Mountain West Tournament. ESPNU has the American Athletic Tournament at 8 p.m. Pac-12's got another Pac-12 Tournament game at 8 p.m. At 8:30 p.m. on ESPN, it's the Atlantic Coast Tournament. ESPN2 has another Big 12 Tournament game. It's a team to be determined versus Baylor. FS1 has the Big East Tournament. SECN has the Southeastern Tournament. 10:30 p.m. on CBS Sports Network, it's the Mountain West Tournament. And FS1 Pac-12 Tournament. Women's college basketball, 4 p.m. ESPNU, it's the Southland Tournament, teams to be determined in the championship game. Major League Baseball on the Major League Baseball Network, the spring training game, New York Mets versus the St. Louis Cardinals. 3 p.m. has a spring training game, is the Oakland Athletics versus the Chicago Cubs. And 6 p.m., spring training game, Baltimore Prospects versus Pittsburgh Prospects. Those are all on the MLB Network. NBA basketball on TNT. It's Phoenix at Boston at 6:30 p.m. And at 9 p.m. on TNT, we've got Dallas at Oklahoma City. True TV also has Dallas at Oklahoma City. Top story on the sports page today is entitled State Champs Represent Area's Best. This is girls high school wrestling. Huck Felt SSC Duo Captain All Area Team. It's written by Ryan Timmerman. The 2023-2024 Sioux City Journal All Area Girls Wrestling Team is captained by its three state champions, Spencer's Olivia Huck Felt and South Sioux City's pair of title winners, Madeline Bonnet and Caitlin Somm. Combined, the trio went 130-3. With 107 wins coming by pinfall. Representing three different grade levels, Huckfelt a senior, Somm a junior, and Bonnet a sophomore, The trio also represents the strides the sport has made over the past few years, as well as the bright future in store for girls wrestling around Siouxland. Huckfeldt was among the trailblazers in Iowa, as the sport has made tremendous strides since being sanctioned ahead of the 2022-2023 season. In her 4 years wrestling at Spencer, Huckfeldt went 116-1 for her high school career, including a 90-0 mark over the last 2 seasons with 69 wins by pin. A University of Sioux Falls women's wrestling and softball recruit, Huckfeldt's only prep loss came as a freshman in the championship match of the Iowa Wrestling Coaches and Officials Association State Tournament, the predecessor to the Iowa Girls High School Athletic Union state-sanctioned championships. She went on to capture 1 IWCOA title and 2 IGHSAU championships. Bonnet and Somm both have eligibility left at South Sioux City as the Cardinals squad has ascended the ranks in Nebraska. This season, SSC qualified for the NSAA Girls' Tournament and placed 3 on the medal stand after the team was a district runner-up. While Huckfeldt seemed like a natural from the beginning, SSC has seen tremendous growth from Somm year over year after she went 19-11 as a freshman. She built on that start to go 24-5 as a sophomore and capture a state championship this winter. Bonnet went 35-5 as a freshman and didn't have much room for improvement after being a state runner-up in 2023. Though she did indeed end with a better finish this season despite the narrow margin as she capped off 2024 atop the medal stand at state. The rest of the SCJ All-Area team features the likes of Sioux City North's Molly Seck, who was a state runner-up in 2023, as well as a half dozen wrestlers from Ridgeview, as the Raptors were among the most represented teams at the Iowa State Championships. And here are the members of the SCJ All-Area Girls Wrestling Team. On the first team at 100 pounds, it's Kiera Ruiz of Spencer, a sophomore. At 105 pounds, it's Madeline Bonnet of South Sioux City, also a sophomore. At 110, it's Lila Walding of Sergeant Bluff Luton Sr. 115 pounds, it's Molly Seck of Sioux City North, a senior. At 120 pounds, Tegan Robertson of Ridgeview, freshman. At 125 pounds, it's Destiny Brown, a Ridgeview junior. At 130 pounds, Tatum Shepherd, a Ridgeview senior. At 135 pounds, Isabella Deeds, a Ridgeview senior. 140 pounds, Shaylee Sutherland, a Spencer junior. 145 pounds, Lucy Konecki, Central Lion George Little Rock, freshman. 155 pounds is Cassie Huss, MOC Floyd Valley sophomore. 170 pounds is Denia Werner of Ridgeview, senior. And 190 pounds, it's Jana Terwee of West Lyon, a senior. 235 pounds has Olivia Huckfeldt from Spencer, who is a senior. At large at 105 pounds is Casey Miller. Our next sports article is entitled MOCFV's Van Kalsbeek Named Mr. Basketball. It's written by Ryan Timmerman. MOC Floyd Valley's Jesse Van Kalsbeek is Iowa's Mr. Basketball for the 2023-2024 season. The senior was selected as the state's top player by the Iowa Print Sports Writers Association on Tuesday and joined a prestigious group of honorees that includes the likes of Fred Hoiberg, Rafe LaFrenz, Nick Collison, and Harrison Barnes, among other highly decorated student athletes. MOC Floyd Valley also produced Mr. Basketball in 2005 when it was won by Josh Van Ess. As a senior, Van Kalsbeek averaged 26 points a game, second most in Class 3A, en route to making his second All-State team. Despite missing 6 games with a hand injury this season, he ended his prep career with 1,376 points, 517 rebounds, 158 assists, 117 steals, and 46 blocks, 31 of which came this season. Van Kalsbeek, a Northwestern College recruit, was joined on the Class 3A first team by Bishop Heelan Sr. Matt Noel, a Wayne State commit. Noel averaged a double-double for the Crusaders as they finished as a sub-state semifinalist. Now a two-time first-team All-Stater, Noel went for 21.1 points and 10.6 rebounds per game this season, plus 2.6 assists and 1.1 steals a contest. In Class 2A, reigning state champions Western Christian saw junior Caden Van Regenmorter named to the first team, while classmate Karsten Moret earned a third-team nod. Van Regenmorter was joined by Central Lyon senior Reese Vanderzee on the 2A first team, and West Lyon junior Carson Hoogeveen was named to the second team. Vanderzee posted 24.6 points per game and 10.5 rebounds this season, plus 2.4 assists and nearly two steals a contest after being named a second-team All-Stater and helping the Lions win a state title as a junior. Van Regenmorter was named captain of the 3A All-State Tournament team after leading the Wolfpack to the title. He averaged 19.1 points per game this season, plus 6.1 rebounds, 3.6 assists, and 1.5 steals. Moret also made the 2A All-State Tournament team after he led the class in scoring at state with an average of over 18 points per game in three games last week in Des Moines. For the season, he posted numbers of 13.5 points, 4.4 rebounds, and 1.5 assists, while shooting over 41% from beyond the three-point line in on 113 attempts. Hoogeveen went for over 16 points a contest, plus 4 assists with nearly 3 rebounds and 3 steals each game. In Class 4A, senior Morningside recruit Fitzy Grant was a second-team selection. Grant led the Black Raiders to a 21-3 season record that included a Missouri River Athletic Conference title and top three rank to end the regular season. He capped his career at East with game averages of 15.3 points, 6.6 rebounds, 2 assists, and 2 steals. Class 1A saw Remsen St. Mary's junior Colin Homan named to the first team and South O'Brien junior Derek Paulson get a second team nod. Homan led the Hawks in scoring and rebounding at 16.5 points and 8 rebounds per game. He also averaged around 1 block, steal, and assist each per outing. He was a third-team All-Stater last season after helping the Hawks get to the state tournament. Paulson averaged 15.5 points, 5 rebounds, and over 2 assists and 2 steals per each game for the Wolverines. In women's college basketball, Nebraska-Iowa women's game draws a major draw. It's written by Brent Wagner of the Lincoln Journal-Star. By winning 3 games in 3 days to reach the Big Ten Women's Basketball Tournament Championship, Nebraska earned itself some major national TV exposure. Iowa's overtime win against the Huskers on Sunday averaged 3.02 million viewers on the CBS broadcast. The broadcast peaked with 4.4 million viewers during overtime. It was the most watched basketball game on any network on Sunday, including NBA and college men. It was also the most watched women's college basketball game on CBS in 25 years. A Tennessee versus Connecticut regular season game in 1999 had 3.8 million viewers. Caitlin Clark, Iowa, and Nebraska also delivered a big TV audience earlier in the season when the Huskers rallied from a 14-point deficit to beat Iowa on February 11th in Lincoln. There were 1.8 million tuned in on Fox. Clark is bringing millions of viewers to the sport this winter. For comparison, the national championship college volleyball match in 2023 with Texas and Nebraska averaged 1.7 million viewers on ABC. In college football, Albert's leaving Huskers for Aggies. It's written by Sam McCowan and Henry Cordes of the World Herald staff writers. Nebraska athletic director Trev Alberts is leaving the school for the same job at the Texas A&M, a source told the World Herald late Wednesday afternoon, confirming a wave of news that hit the state and the athletic department earlier in the day. Nebraska baseball coach Will Bolt was with his team in Wichita. Men's basketball coach Fred Hoiberg prepared to take his team to Minneapolis for the Big Ten tournament. Football coach Matt Rule, squeezing in a few vacation days before spring camp, was in Scotland golfing. Husker coaches scattered across the world got a surprise Wednesday when multiple media reports surfaced that Alberts was a top target for the same job at Texas A&M. After hours of speculation, a source said Wednesday he's leaving roughly 1 week after A&M reached out with interest. Alberts interviewed with A&M officials last weekend. Earlier Wednesday, a Nebraska official said Alberts had not informed interim system president Chris Kaborek that he was leaving to lead the Aggies. A&M is an SEC program known for Kyle Field, its 102,000-seat football stadium, and deep-pocketed donors who helped the school cover a $75 million buyout after firing football coach Jimbo Fisher last season. A&M Associate Athletic Director Alan Cannon also released a statement Wednesday afternoon refuting that Alberts had already accepted the job. Texas A&M President Mark Welsh appointed a 7-person committee to search for our new Director of Athletics, Cannon's statement read, "I have not received any notification from the president or anyone on the committee at this time." A&M will have to pony up another $4.12 million to buy out Alberts' contract at Nebraska, who signed an 8-year extension with NU last fall. He was set to make $1.7 million in each of the next 3 years before getting a bump to $2.1 million in 2026. Alberts would have received stay bonuses in years 2026 through 2031 and a contract completion bonus of $3 million if he remained at Nebraska through August 31, 2031. Alberts becomes the second athletic director to leave Nebraska for Texas A&M. Bill Byrne did so in the early 2000s. Byrne spent 11 seasons at Nebraska. Alberts has just begun the fundraising process for the Memorial Stadium overhaul. According to a source, he was targeted for the college football playoff executive director job, vacated by Bill Hancock, but chose not to take that role. That brings us to the end of today's reading in the Sioux City Journal. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.